Good evening and welcome to episode 7 of season 4 of the Ubuntu UK podcast. It's Tuesday the 24th of May 2011, and in this episode we are going to talk to Philip Heckel about the open source Dropbox alternative Synchony. We're also going to talk to the bearded community wrangler that is Jono the Bacon. We're going to have It's About Ubuntu, Not About Ubuntu, your feedback. We're going to have the results of our competition, and have I missed anything?
No.
That's it. And we're going to have a little bit of chat starting about now. Alan, how are you?
Hello, I'm fine, thank you.
Good, good, good.
Good to be back in Studio A.
I know.
Without the video.
Or the dishwasher.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
The famous dishwasher.
I think your dishwasher has caused several minor road traffic accidents and possibly a flight.
It's got its own Twitter account now. Yes. I didn't set it up. Someone set up dishwasher popey. Twitter.com/dishwasherpopey. And it goes beep, beep, beep. And that's about it. And I think one other tweet that said the iOS devices get all the love in this house.
Well, we actually had people who went out to their kitchen during the course of the listening to the podcast because they thought their dishwasher would stop.
So are we going to insert any sound effects in this show?
No, there will be real events. If
real cats.
Real right, cats good. Or possibly people at the door. You never know.
Anything
could happen. What have you been up to?
This week I got a message from a friend who said my dad wants Linux installed on his computer. So I did it and I went around there last night and gave him back his laptop with Windows wiped off it and 1104 with Unity installed.
And how did he find that?
Yeah, he turned it on, logged in, and he just
said, "What? I wanted GNOME Shell."
And he went, "Oh, look, there's Firefox. Yeah, I use that." And then he went, proceeded to log on to eBay and check his auctions, logged on to his email and did that. And logged on to some web-based poker website and was playing poker. And then he went, "Oh, I think you're done here, aren't you?" Seriously. And he went, "You can go home now." Oh, honestly. Wow. And he gave me 2 bottles of port, which was good.
That sounds like a fair exchange.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was it. I've only had one email from him, which was, "I can't get the webcam working. I've put the Logitech CD in the drive and it doesn't seem to work." So I replied saying, "I think you'll find Ubuntu has all the drivers you need. Just plug it in and see what happens." And he did. And then he emailed me back and goes, "God, this is very clever."
Excellent.
Excellent. Yeah. Okay. Mark's here as well.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm very well.
You're old, I understand.
I am slightly older than I was.
Excellent. Aren't we all?
Yes.
But you're significantly older.
Well, I've passed a milestone in my age in the past 2 weeks.
Wow. What's the milestone? Come on, fess up.
I should never ask a lady her age, Tony.
A lady with that beard.
Especially a lady with this beard.
Okay, well, you can be coy about it if you want.
23.
Vastly younger than any of us.
The rest of us combined. Did you have a good birthday?
I had a very good birthday. I think my neck and my head have just about recovered from my night out.
That good a birthday, eh?
Yes.
Yeah. And what about you, Laura? Any big nights out?
No.
Yeah, okay. You're keeping her locked up, aren't you?
So yeah. What have you done then?
I went to present about usability at Imperial College yesterday.
Oh, wow.
Which is quite good fun. Very good fun, in fact, and hopefully I might be able to find someone to do an interview in a future episode.
Ooh. That'd be good.
Yeah. And also, I've spent many, many hours over the past few weeks producing a survey on household energy usage. So I'm hoping that I can pimp it enough. I'll get 200 people reply in the next 3 weeks.
Oh, blimey.
But you can't give out a URL yet?
Not on here, but that's not ideal anyway. Hopefully I'll be able to put a link in the show notes if nobody minds tomorrow night.
Yeah, conflict of interest.
So, it'll be fine.
And presumably you're going to tweet it as well?
I will tweet it, I will Facebook it, I will blog it.
So if people follow you on Twitter, where you are?
Laura Cowan.
Okay, they can find out
the
there.
Link's on the website.
Okay, cool. Excellent.
What have you been up to, Tony?
I've, apart from having a slight cough and cold this evening, I've been doing a project management course this week. Ooh. So I've been
Let's get on with the show.
He has a Gantt chart.
Course. Yeah, this is it. As somebody who has made Gantt charts for the cooking of meals in the past,
Are you serious?
He's serious.
Yeah, for Sunday lunches. I used to do that. I was young and naive. Those were heady days. You go and see the time of days like that.
We had good cheesy leeks, though.
So I'm really, I've been doing mock exams every evening this week, and I've got about 4.5 hours of exam to come later this week. So I really should get on with this show.
Yes.
Let's do that.
That's
now.
That's probably for the best.
Hello,
to Philip Heckel, who's called us from Germany, and he's going to talk about his Synchony project, which is an open source cloud storage and file sharing application. So, hello, Philip.
Hey, Laura.
Would you like to explain in your own words what Synchony is?
Sure. So Synchony, as you said, is a file synchronization and file sharing application. It basically allows you to synchronize certain folders of your computer to the internet and between different computers. So for those of you who know Dropbox, it's pretty much like Dropbox. So basically you download Synchony, you install it on your computer, you select a bunch of folders that you want to sync, and then you select what type of storage you want to sync it to, so for example an FTP server or Gmail. Then you choose a password to encrypt your data, and then you click OK. And from that moment on, Synchony automatically detects the changes you make to your files and synchronizes them to the internet. So assuming that you have more than one computer or you just want to share files and folders with friends and colleagues, you can connect any existing to any existing data repository and from different machines and keep them in sync. So in terms of the basic functionality and also of the look and feel for the user, Synchony behaves just like Dropbox would do. So once it's set up, the application acts in the background and almost completely invisible to the user. The only thing that you'll see as a user is a little green and blue icons on the files that indicate that something is going on in the background. So while the user interface is really similar to Dropbox, Synchony has two major advantages, I think, over the other synchronization software. The first thing is that it encrypts your data locally. So whenever you add a file to Synchony or to one of the Synchony folders, it chunks the file in little pieces and encrypts them before you actually upload it.
And that's different from Dropbox, isn't it?
That is different from Dropbox. Dropbox, well, I don't know if it encrypts the data, but it doesn't do it locally. So the Dropbox employees and a potential attacker could see the file if they wanted to.
What
means is whenever you store your data, there's no one except you that can decrypt and read the file you've uploaded. That is not your internet service provider, not the storage provider, or not an attacker can read the file.
What sort of encryption? You mentioned that your files are encrypted. What encrypt? Do you use open standard encryption technologies or some proprietary thing? How do you encrypt the files before you send them?
Well, it's open source, so it's not proprietary.
Good.
basically, you can choose what encryption do you want. Right now, it's the advanced encryption standard, the AES. But basically, it can be any encryption. It's not public key infrastructure, so it's symmetric key encryption. That's the first advantage. So you could potentially store financial documents or any critical business data in the cloud. And the second advantage, I think, is that Synchony is not bound to any type of storage or any type of storage protocol. It can basically use any type of storage, be it your own FTP server, a web dev server, a Samba share in the local area network, and, of course, the commercial providers such as Amazon S3 or Rackspace Cloud Files.
So you don't actually have like a separate server component which you have to install. It's just storage somewhere.
It's just the client. You install the client on the computer and you connect directly to the storage.
Cool.
So
and is it all graphical? There's no like command line monkeying around or config files that I have to deal with.
Well, right now, obviously it's in a very early development stage. So right now there is a lot of command line involved, but in the end it should be something as easy as Dropbox. That's one of my goals, to keep it simple so that the average user can use it without having to go to the command line and do something like that.
And when you say there's like any kind of storage, so from an average user's point of view, they don't really have any picture of where stuff is stored. It's kind of, I synchronize this stuff and it disappears onto the internet somewhere and it's stored somewhere. Is this an extra barrier that someone's going to have to go and set some remote storage up somewhere, or is there some kind of straightforward you could point it at your, you know, your Gmail account or some what's the easiest way you can make it for someone to set it up in, with a storage that they already have?
Well, the Gmail is always the first thing that pops into your head because it's 7 gigabytes.
Yeah,
it's out there and you could theoretically use it. And in fact, Synchrony also supports IMAP, so you can use your email account as online storage. It chunks the files and uploads the chunks and saves them as email attachment. But that definitely violates the Google agreement.
A little bit.
I'm not sure if one should use that, but it is theoretically possible. Yes.
But if you had a corporate email account that, you know, and your IT policy wasn't being violated, then, you know, potentially you could point it at a different IMAP server. It doesn't have to be like Gmail. You said it supports IMAP.
Yeah, it supports IMAP. So you can use any IMAP server or any mail account you have. Yeah. I even experimented with for providers that don't have IMAP yet, to send it via SMTP and retrieve the files via POP.
That's
so
brilliant.
It also works, but it's really, really slow.
And
yeah,
but it works. I have one particular thing that I really like is to store the files in images and use Picasa as a data repository. So it basically encodes file chunks into bitmaps and uploads them to Picasa web albums.
And so if someone went to that Picasa web album, is it a private web album or is it public? And if someone looked, they just see loads of corrupted images or something?
Well, it is encrypted. So even if it was public, nobody would be able to read it. But Picasa offers offers the possibility to only let certain people access it, which makes it really great for sharing purposes because you can specify, okay, this user, I want this user to have access to the album, and they can even contribute files, so they can upload files to the Picasa album, but they can't delete my own files, so this makes Picasa the perfect repository.
And are there any kind of optimal, do you have to tweak settings to get optimal saving in a bitmap or a PNG or IMAP or anything like that, or is it just kind of all done for you and you deal with that in the client?
Well, it is for the bitmap thing. It is encoded as actual BMP file because the BMP header is only 40 bytes long, so it looks like a normal image. You don't have to set up anything. It does everything for you. Is that your question?
I'm just interested to know what overhead a user has to deal with, you know, in setting this kind of thing up. You know, if it's a case of just point it at a Picasa web album and off we go, that's fantastic.
It. Like basically, you just right now you just enter your Google username, your password, and then the album ID, which now is an actual ID, but later will be just the URL. So there's no configuration at all except that.
Wow. So what if we rewind, when did you start this and what prompted you? What made you want to start developing this project?
Well, it's basically all to do with Dropbox. I started about 2 years ago when I first discovered Dropbox and installed it in my computer and saw how amazing it is, how it just worked, how you could copy something into a folder and magically get synced to all these other attached computers. That really amazed me. So I used Dropbox for a while, and I still use it, of course. But at some point, I realized that it had issues, and the first one is the clear lack of confidentiality that we already talked about.
Yeah.
When you copy something in the Dropbox folder, you have to think twice. You really want this to be on someone else's server. Do you really want other people to be able to see this?
Mm.
Because you, as a user, you have no control over where your data is stored, or who gets to see it, or who potentially could see it. And this may be not a problem for some of your files, but for financial documents or for business documents, this is a big issue. And the second thing is, With Dropbox and all the other commercial providers, you're dependent of one provider. So be it Ubuntu One or Jungle Disk, they all have a commercial point of view. They offer a limited amount of free storage to get you hooked, of course, and then you have to pay. I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but because those companies, I mean, they have to make their living. But I always tend to ask myself, what if the company goes bankrupt? Or what if they suddenly decide it's not free anymore? And why do I have to pay for Dropbox if I get 7 gigabytes from Gmail for free?
Well, I guess one of the benefits of all these syncing tools is you still get to keep your data. Your data is still on your machine. Yeah. I mean, there is still the risk that, you know, someone evil could take over, you know, Dropbox or whoever that provider is, and they could do something with all that data that's on their server. And that's certainly a worry. I mean, I personally stopped using Dropbox, so this whole topic interests me greatly. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, after I realized that these issues exist, I started looking for alternatives. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is not to develop your own software, but yeah. to just look for alternatives if something's out there that's similarly easy and, secure.
So is there nothing else that satisfied your criteria that was already being developed then? Because exactly, I know there's a few sort of open source projects around this, but...
Exactly. I mean, there's one that caught my attention. It's called SparkleShare.
Yeah.
I think you also mentioned it on the show sometime. But it uses JIT or Git as a repository, which is not encrypted. And so even if I had my own server, it would be still on this server. And my service provider would be able to access it. So there wasn't basically nothing out there that only encrypted the data on your machine and then uploaded it. Mm.
So what's the roadmap for the future? You've said you're interested in getting new contributors to the project. What are the plans? What's the features that you want to add?
So the immediate. The primary goal is to release a beta version for people to test it, because right now it's just the code and a couple of instructions how to compile it and run it. But I wouldn't say that it's stable enough for users to test it. So the next goal is to develop a version that could be used by actual users so that they could test it and give feedback and find bugs and feature requests and all. In terms of features, I think a cool thing would be if Synchrony could handle more than one storage at the same time. So, for example, to combine them logically to a bigger disk. So, for example, you could use two Gmail accounts or one Gmail account and an Amazon S3 account and then combine them to a bigger disk of 14 gigabytes.
Or maybe a Google Apps account for domains, and then 300 Gmail accounts, all of 25 gig each.
For example, yeah.
Wow.
Another thing is, if you want to focus on high availability, you could use two accounts to mirror. So you use one at Rackspace Cloud Files and one at Amazon S3. So if one of them goes down for some reason or gets attacked or taken over, you still would have the other account to use, and you would basically wouldn't see that someone happened. So that's basically what I'll concentrate on. And another thing is, it's part of my master thesis, is to minimize the amount of space storage that Synchrony uses in its repository, and to optimize the bandwidth that it uses. So this topic has a lot to do with how to really efficiently break the files into smaller chunks and detect duplicates. Yeah, so that's basically the roadmap.
So the screenshots and the feature list on the website sound pretty impressive, considering the first code was made available yesterday. Is that the first release? First available code.
The first code, I released the first code yesterday, exactly. I wanted to give you guys a working version on Sunday, but I didn't make that.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic.
I at least released the code so that other people could play around. And I saw that Mark already did try to run it, right?
Yeah, I've given you a couple of bug reports already.
What's it written in, out of interest? What languages, libraries do you use?
It's It's almost entirely written in Java. So I'd say about 95% are absolutely platform independent, so it could run on any platform that supports Java. However, there are a few things that need to be implemented in the native environment. So, for example, the integration in the file manager
Right.
is completely different on Windows, Linux, and Mac.
Okay.
For the Linux version, I was lucky because I could simply use the Nautilus extension that Dropbox wrote.
So I
reused their GPL code and really modified it in, like, 10 lines of code so that it could work with Synchrony.
Fantastic.
Cool. So,
yeah, but for Windows Explorer plugin and for the Finder plugin on Mac, those have to be written from scratch. And, well, I don't know how to write C or C-sharp code, so I'd really hope to get some developers who could do that on those platforms.
Which is
this is an Ubuntu podcast, but you never
know. Which is exactly what I was about to ask you. At the moment, rather than users per se, it's developers and, I assume, testers that you're looking for at the moment. Where would people contact you if they're interested in helping out?
Well, the website is synchrony.org. Mm-hmm. That's spelled like synchrony.org.
And we'll have that and a link to that in our show notes, I think.
Yeah, okay. And there's a link to the Launchpad site, which is where the code is hosted and where bugs are going to be tracked. And so you could basically ask on Launchpad or drop me an email as you like. I really appreciate every kind of help or suggestion.
Great.
Future requests.
Brilliant. Well, thanks very much for talking to us. That was really, really interesting.
Yeah. We look forward to
see how it goes. Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, then.
Cheers.
Cheers, then. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And now it's time for the news. A paper has been published by Invisible Things Labs demonstrating vulnerabilities in current Intel processors, allowing an attacker to gain access to the host operating system on Zen virtual machines.
Oh no, disaster. Is this going to be a disaster for all people running VPSs?
Maybe.
Unless they run on VMware.
Yeah.
Oh, that's completely invulnerable, I guess.
It's something to do with Sandy Bridge, isn't it?
Oh,
the new Intel chipset. So maybe anybody who's actually currently got the servers all right.
I always thought this was one of those things that was always touted as you should never trust the fact that you're inside a VM and this whole blue pill thing of being able to get out of the matrix and, you know.
It's all to do with Ring Zero.
Oh, okay.
That's my technical explanation.
Thanks for that.
Miguel de Casa and other Mono developers formerly at Novell have started a new company, Xamarin, dedicated to continuing Mono development and support following Attachmate's recent acquisition of Novell. The company's stated goals focus on mobile platforms aiming to bring native .NET support and later Moonlight support to iOS and Android.
This is a good thing, isn't it?
It's good. I mean, Novell seems to have basically got rid of all the .NET developers. Yeah. Sorry, the Mono developers.
Yeah.
And they're not very happy about that and have tried to go their own, which they can do because it's open source.
Yeah, well, it's free software.
Yeah, that too.
Yeah. French hacker extraordinaire Fabrice Bellard from the QMU and FFmpeg projects has written a PC emulator in JavaScript capable of booting a Linux system within a web browser. The system currently only supports local command line functionality, but Bellard hopes that it could be used for JavaScript benchmarking or allowing complex processing such as cryptography to be performed client-side.
This is really quite cool.
It's brilliant.
But I don't know why.
Well, yeah, you could boot Linux in a browser. And then you look at it and think, that was good.
You can compile a test C program and run it.
And you can use Emacs.
Oh, great.
A special version of Emacs.
But there's no kind of... the storage isn't...
persistent.
What's the word? Persistent. That's the word I'm looking for. Thank you. So, you know, it's of limited use at the moment, but it's a proof of concept. It's great.
That's fantastic.
It's amazing.
And
it's surprising it boots so quick as well.
Yeah.
Well, presumably... It runs in another instance effectively inside a sort of VM on the server inside JavaScript, I guess.
No, it's on your browser. Machine.
It's running it's in the Firefox or the Chrome or the IE JavaScript engine on your browser.
Oh, right. Okay, so it doesn't take any server-side resources other than sending the information out.
Yeah, so it basically downloads the kernel and a disk image with the page and then boots it in JavaScript.
This is what I've just been boggling around. I'm like, what?
Okay, so
it's great.
It hosts your own resources rather than somebody else's.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
I mean, I was interested in things like JavaScript-based Spectrum emulators for retro, but this is just, hang on, Linux, that's current. That's this is booting a current kernel, not like 20-year-old technology.
Yeah, but you only get a 20-year-old operating environment, Emacs. It's time for some events, and the Ubuntu UK people are planning on visiting the science fiction exhibition at the British Library this summer, probably followed by a Geeknik, which is a picnic in a park with geeks. Mm. You can check out the Ubuntu UK mailing list for more information.
Yeah, I went to one last year. I took my wife and children, and we had a great time playing in the park in London, frisbees and falling over and eating ice cream and chit-chat and... It's good stuff. It was nice to get outside and see a bit of the big blue room rather than being indoors. It was good.
I thought that was an IBM reference there for a minute. And most importantly, we've got OggCamp coming up on the 13th and 14th of August. There are tickets available. We made another batch available, so get them while you can. There aren't that many left, so get them while they're hot. It's in Farnham Maltings in Farnham in Surrey, 13th and 14th of August this summer. There's an Eventbrite page where you can sign up to register for the tickets, so please do that. The suggested hotel, if you want to stay overnight, either on Friday, Saturday or Sunday nights or whatever, is the Premier Inn in Aldershot. Google that up and it'll come up as the first hit. We are after people who want to exhibit. If you've got a stand or something cool, something funky you want to show off, it doesn't have to be a company or a professional thing at all. In fact, it's cooler if it's not sometimes.
Yep.
Then send us an email, ogcamp@ubuntu-uk.org. And if you're interested in being on the crew as well, helping out, carrying things, running things, video cameras and microphones and all that sort of stuff.
Speaking of video cameras, Alan Bell is leading up the video team, and the plan is to video as much as we can and get it online as soon as possible. No faffing around with editing or anything. So for those people who can't attend,
yes,
we should be able to get content up as soon as possible.
But you do have to attend.
Yes.
So come along. Because it is a bar camp, and one of the things about that is it's as cool as you make it. So if you come along with cool ideas or something you want to share, a talk idea or something like that, or just a discussion you want to have, then you can basically make that happen. Cool, check that out.
And after that extended musical interlude, we have the pleasure of introducing you to the one and only Jono Bacon. How are you doing, Jono?
Good. Thanks, folks, for inviting me on.
Good. I'm glad to see that you're actually there after waiting for 5 minutes for us. So, how was UDS then?
UDS was really good. It's always a pretty nerve-wracking event for my team at Canonical because we organise a big chunk of it in terms of getting the schedule together. Within the team, you know, everything up until Monday morning is essentially unbridled terror. And then once Monday morning's out of the way, the keynotes are done, we can then start relaxing into the week. But it was a big UDS. We had something like 15 different rooms, so 15 sessions going at any one time. There was a huge amount of Linaro content, a ton of Ubuntu content, and but it all went. It all went pretty swimmingly, and I still have a job, so it must have gone all right.
Well, it's good. I've heard some people say they think it was the busiest UDS yet. Is that fair in your assumption?
Yeah, it was. We'll put it this way. I mean, I think this was the 11th UDS that I've been to, and it's the first UDS in which we were worried about breaking the fire limit in terms of getting people into the plenary room. We had about 550 people show up at UDS this time around.
And, wow.
Yeah, there was a lot of content. I mean, there was a lot of tracks, a lot of rooms, a lot of content. There's a huge amount of sessions that took place. But, you know, I mean, the whole point of UDS is that people can make plans for the next 6 months. And, you know, the number of sessions really doesn't mean anything. It's whether people manage to come to those decisions. And
I've seen a lot of the videos from some of those sessions are already online on the YouTube channel and the Ubuntu Developers Blip channel as well. So people can see, you know, how the discussions went around the, you know, the decision-making process and some of the plenaries and keynotes as well. And I noticed since you've been back from UDS, you've been blogging quite prolifically. And one of the things that I was particularly interested in was this reinvigoration of the Ubuntu Power Users team. And I just want to ask you what you consider a power user is in this context. Isn't it someone who uses Arch Linux?
Well, yeah, you know, one of the first snarky responses to this was, well, why don't people just use Debian, you know?
Yeah.
And the reason why I set this up was because, you know, as Ubuntu's been developing over the years, we've been focusing increasingly on targeting mums and dads of the world, you know, end users who don't necessarily have a huge amount of technical knowledge. You know, Ubuntu should be as attractive as an Android phone or an iPhone or, you know, something as simplistic as that in terms of people doing what they want to do, getting access to software and that kind of thing. But one piece of feedback that I've seen, particularly since Unity entered the distro, was, and I think it's a reasonable piece of feedback, is that Ubuntu is becoming less suitable for power users. These are people who, you know, who want to configure the hell out of their desktops. They want the kind of people who want to have, you know, statistics about their hardware on their desktop while they're working.
KDE users.
Exactly. It's just a ton of different levels of configuration. The kind of people who adjust the transparency of their panels and that kind of thing. And my view has always been that while Unity covers up a lot of the details that a lot of end users don't need to know about, the configurability is still largely under that surface.
And is it not also true that it's just not finished yet? And a lot of the configurability is hidden by virtue of the code hasn't been written.
Well, that's a big chunk of it as well. Is that, you know, I mean, in the natty cycle, it was about taking some pre-existing Unity designs, porting it to Compiz, refining some extra bits, and doing all of this within 6 months to a sufficient level of quality. And I'm really proud of what the team managed to accomplish, but there are big chunks of configuration and the configurability of Unity definitely missing. But when I was reading this feedback, some of this criticism, the first thing that struck me was, well, why don't we just have a community of people who work on tools and work in documentation and build this kind of support post-installation. So you'd install a NATI system or an ERIC system, and then, you know, you can install a kitchen sink application, which has got all of your configuration options in there. There's a community where you can get support, and there's no reason why we can't support, in my mind, both types of user. And that's the reason why I set it up. And I mean, all I did was make a mailing list and write a few blog entries, and the community's just really taken the idea to heart and they're doing some really great work.
Do you think that there is a loss of power users from Ubuntu? Is there an active drift, or is this a preemptive strike to stop them from going to other versions or other distros?
I think we've been seeing some people leave, and I think this is just the nature of the evolution of Ubuntu. I've been seeing that the Fedora project have been experiencing some similar unrest with certain users. There was this "We Want Our Distro Back" campaign in the Fedora world, and what I've seen there is that a bunch of people at Red Hat want to take the Fedora more along the lines of Ubuntu and design it around essentially consumers, and put the hardcore component inside Fedora who want, you know, that more extended level of configurability. So I don't think we're the only project that's facing this, but I think that we're seeing it more and more as design is more and more part of how we build Ubuntu. You know, the fact that we have a whole team of people in the Aitana project who sit there all day thinking about the finest level of detail about how we can avoid complexity, I think is meaning that, you know, Ubuntu by definition is getting easier and easier to use, and that will be disconcerting for some types of user who want that level of control.
So where you say, like, maybe other distros who are doing a similar sort of thing are seeing this drift too, where do you think they're going? What is it that, you know, Ubuntu is going to need to provide that other, which other distros provide it at the moment?
You know, it's the main distro that I've seen this happening in, the main distro where I've seen a lot of these discussions has been Fedora. I haven't really seen it with OpenSUSE, or I haven't seen it with Debian. I'm not sure if there's any Mageia users
at all.
But I've seen it with Fedora mainly, and I haven't seen what they're trying to do to remedy the situation over there. I'd hope that they try and approach a similar kind of solution, as in just trying to provide different types of community support for different types of users. I mean, my view has always been that, look, if you've got kind of consumers and power users, if you have Ubuntu out of the box as a system designed for power users, it's going to, by definition, probably put off a bunch of consumers, because they'll end up tripping over configuration options and it'll feel too complicated. So I think it's much easier to, you know, once you get that newer, you know, that new Ubuntu smell, and you install it on your system, to install all this stuff afterwards, and it makes it a lot easier. So, for example, one of the things that's been discussed is there's a tool called Ubuntu Tweak. I wrote this blog entry about suggesting that we have a single interface for performing any level of configuration in Ubuntu. And a bunch of people responded, I think Popey was one of them, saying, well, have you seen Ubuntu Tweak? And it solves much of what that vision is. So I emailed the author of Ubuntu Tweak and said, hey, they set this new community up. Would you like to participate in it? There's a bunch of people who are interested in helping out. And there was discussions going on about, for example, making sure that new users don't install this kitchen sink application and screw their system up. So having backups and rollbacks and that kind of stuff in terms of providing a safe environment. So now that's happening inside the community as well.
Okay. One of the questions that we had from some of our listeners is, do you think that it's possible or worthwhile to nurture our existing developers on a path towards app creation? As in, the developer community changes as it gets easier to make new applications and package applications. Is it going to be easier for people to become developers and have applications in Ubuntu than it is currently? And does that overall reduce the quality of the applications, perhaps?
In terms of, one of the problems that we have, I think, is that the term developer in the Ubuntu world is heavily overloaded. It can mean people who package software, so somebody who takes Firefox and packages it and puts it in the Ubuntu Software Center, or it can mean people who write code to make applications that run on Ubuntu. I think traditionally we've served the packaging demographic, reasonably well. That's still a continual area of focus that we want to improve, so it's easier to participate as a developer in Ubuntu as a packager. But the second area, in terms of application authors, is definitely a significant area of focus that we're working on. So we've inside Canonical, there's been this group called Software Strategy, which is basically encompasses things like developer.ubuntu.com, the Software Center, and it's designed, this group is designed to try and figure out what we need to do to make it easier for application authors to go from knowing nothing about the Ubuntu platform to writing applications for Ubuntu and getting it into the Software Center. And of course, there's different types of apps. I mean, you've got things like Angry Birds, which are closed source, you know, paid for apps. And then you've got other applications such as Frozen Bubble, which is, you know, an open source game. So, different types of developer require different things, and there's a bunch of different things that we're focusing on. So Ubuntu Software Center is getting better and better. There's ratings and reviews in there, so I think the exposure to applications is continuing to improve. One of the things we've always struggled with is actually getting the apps inside the archive, because traditionally you've had to convince an Ubuntu developer who's been through months and months of training to get the app in there. So we've now got this application review board where an application author can package it in a PPA, and then they can just propose it to this group, who essentially assess the quality and then then they can get it into the distro even when it's been released already. So application authors today could release software for Natty even though it's been released, and that was a fairly new thing that we did a few UDSs back.
And related to that, a further question, this is from Evan. Do you think it's possible and worthwhile to nurture our existing developers on a path towards app creation? So I guess he's talking about when you say about developers, we've got people who are currently packagers or triagers, or, you know, who their development consists of one-line patches. Should we push them towards app creation, or should we just be pulling in people from the outside?
I think it's a bit of both. I mean, to me, when we go out there and we work on building this application developer community, we should be, to me, the outreach is both people who've never used Ubuntu before and probably new to Ubuntu, as well as people who are familiar with the platform, maybe already doing some software development. One thing we've seen a lot of is people who are upstream developers who use Ubuntu as their development environment. So I think those kinds of people are easier to get on board. I think one of the things I've seen a lot with community management is it's always easier to focus on people who've already got some kind of relationship with the platform as your first group, because that group of people are going to be the kind of people who are going to identify issues and problems that you probably want to resolve before you go after complete randoms.
Right.
So we definitely want to. I don't think it would make so much sense to target packages, because it's really a different kind of skill set, and I think a different kind of interest as well. I think people who are interested in packaging might not necessarily be interested in writing games or utilities or whatever for Ubuntu. But, you know, I mean, we should definitely reach out to them anyway.
Another of our listeners, hello, by the way, another of our listeners, .waffle, says the biggest barrier to Ubuntu adoption is awareness, and without seeming like zealots, how best can the community get involved?
This is something that we're talking a lot about actually right now, is at UDS, Mark Shuttleworth dropped into into his keynote, this 200 million user goal within 4 years. It's funny because I'd heard this number bandied around internally in Canonical, and I never really thought a lot of it. I just thought that was just a way of visualizing what we're trying to do. So it kind of came a bit of a surprise to me when I...
And it's your job to realize that.
yeah, exactly. And, you know, that spans so many different areas. I mean, I had a call today with our communications team, who essentially are marketing people, and, you know, about how you can reach out to different demographics of people, different types of users in different areas, without relying on really expensive types of marketing, such as, you know, TV advertising, which is just insanely expensive. So there's lots of different components to solving that problem. But I think a key area, I've always thought that one of the most impressive things that we have in Ubuntu is our LOCO community, the Ubuntu local user groups, of which obviously Ubuntu UK is one of them. And one thing that we had some discussions at UDS about is, I think we have a really great way of looking at the different types of teams. So if you go to loco.ubuntu.com, you can see the teams that are available, and you can join a team and you can add an event for a team relatively easily. But one thing that we don't have, right, is a regular flow of content that is happening that inspires the rest of the community to participate. So, for example, we have planet.ubuntu.com, which is a great way of seeing what's going on in Ubuntu, and having that regular feed of content of what other people are doing, I think, inspires a lot of people to participate in their own ways. But we don't really have that for the LOCO teams. And one of the discussions at UDS is that I said to the group, I want to see loco.ubuntu.com become tab-worthy. And what I mean by that is that it's always in my Firefox or Chromium browser, and it's just this page that is showing all of the greatest work that's going on in Ubuntu, the latest pictures that have gone on Flickr at LOCO events, you know, the Twitter streams, blog entries, all that kind of stuff. So somebody looks at this and feels inspired. Because I think when we have that resource there, it will also encourage teams to send best practice around how they do stuff. Well, one guy that was at the UDS is this guy called Randall Ross, who's on Planet Ubuntu, and he's the community manager at the Vancouver LOCO team. And just the work that they do in that team is just outstanding. I mean, he gave me these this huge sticker, like almost like a bumper sticker for a car, and they printed like 1,000 of these, and they were putting them out across the city, and they organized huge events and release parties, and, you know, they're just really impressive work, and I think we need a resource in which we can distill people like Randall's knowledge, we can distill that knowledge across the community so everybody can learn. To me, we need to do a certain amount of mechanical work to get that into loco.ubuntu.com before we can provide the best medium in which that best practice can flow between different teams.
Isn't that very, very difficult to do, because each loco, I mean, there's the cultural difference between each loco and the language barrier, and, you know, they all do things differently. But each loco is concentrating on their own footprint, and they have enough work to do in their own area, let alone disseminating that out to all the other locos in the world.
I mean, and part of the challenge here, I think, is figuring out the best way in which people can, in which we can do this in a fairly low bandwidth way. So, as an example, one of the suggestions was that loco.ubuntu.com could essentially have something akin to a planet. And because a lot of blogs can kick out RSS feeds based upon a particular tag, you know, if a loco team writes a news entry on their blog and they just need to tag it and then it appears on loco.ubuntu.com, then it's a very low bandwidth way of doing things. So we're trying to figure out the best ways. I mean, it's The sharing best practice is always complicated, and one of the things that we've discussed in Canonical that we could organize some kind of leadership event for some logo teams, but that in itself is expensive and only reaches a certain proportion of the teams.
Yeah.
So I think the first step is really providing a means in which, I think before we can do anything, we need to get all eyes looking at the same spot in terms of the logo community. And right now, we don't even have that. Once we solve that problem, I think we can then look at lots of interesting ideas about how to solve the rest of it.
Cool. Well, unfortunately, we haven't got time to solve that while you're still on the line. But thank you very much.
We were so close.
I know. Another 5 minutes and we'd have cracked it. But, you know, there's there's emails to read out. But thank you very much indeed for talking to us, Jono. It is a pleasure as ever to speak to you. And best of luck for you and your horsemen for this cycle. And hopefully we'll get to speak to you again before too long.
Sounds great. Thanks a lot, folks.
Right. See ya.
Bye-bye. Cheers,
bye.
Bye.
We set a competition in the last show. It was a bit impromptu, and we kind of made it up on the spot. And
it was good fun, though.
It was.
Give all of our secrets away.
What was the challenge that we set the people?
The challenge was to send us an audio file of you saying Oneric Ocelot, how you pronounce it, your name and how you pronounce it. And we would listen to them and laugh at them and then choose one that was the best for in whatever way we determine the best is, and then send you loads of stuff.
Yeah, so we're going to play out some of the entries we received. Three people sent us entries in weird and wonderful audio formats that didn't open. So, you know, they immediately...
So you kind of win in a way, because I did say, you know, try and send us stuff we can't open.
Yeah, I didn't try very hard, to be honest. It didn't
well,
open.
Those people...
I tried every program I already had installed.
I might send them stickers. Just for being fantastic, and
okay.
It's probably awkward. Just dev you random into a file. And
okay, we had quite a few from people in the Ubuntu community who decided to use computers to generate the saying, but not all of them, and they're all different. So the first one up is from Alan Bell.
Hello, my name is Orca, the Ubuntu screen reader, and I pronounce the next release of Ubuntu as Oneric Ocelot.
I think that was Orca, the Ubuntu screen reader.
Yes.
Not the whale. The next
God,
one.
Man, if you have to put up with that, that's really hard.
Yeah, but you play it extra fast if you use a screen reader.
Yeah.
Do you? Yeah. Faster than that?
Yeah, yeah. You play it super fast because it gets really quicker.
Sorry.
Next one was from Andreas.
Hello, my name is Andreas, and I pronounce Oneric Ocelot as Ocelote Onirico.
Oh,
there you go. That's good. And the next one, I promise you, is from CD Man.
Hello, my nickname is CD Man, and the name for the next version of Ubuntu is pronounced Oneric Ocelot.
He's not a computer. He sounds a bit like one.
Strange background noise.
Compression artifact, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. And Dennis Lehane sent us this one.
My name is Dennis Lehane, and I pronounce Ubuntu 11.10 as Oneric Ocelot.
Okay, thank you, Dennis. We also had this one, which is another computer one.
Hi, I'm Doris from the CCHits.net podcast, and I pronounce the name of the next release as 11.11, or in a push, I pronounce it Oneric Ocelot.
Doris, ooh,
I
think I just had a flashback of Portal.
That was care of John Spriggs, I believe. We have this one from Evgeny Kuznetsov.
Hi, my name is Evgeny Kuznetsov, and being from Russia, I pronounce the next Ubuntu release name as Sonny Ocelot, although I'm pretty sure there is a more correct translation of the term Oneric. Thank you.
Fantastic.
Wow, all the way from Russia. And Ian Cuthbertson sent us this one.
Hi, my name is Ian Cuthbertson, and I pronounce Oneric Ocelot as Oneric Ocelot.
Very straightforward and to the point. And this one's from Johan Vervelot.
My name is Vinisky Kovalord, and I pronounce the Ubuntu 11.10 code name as Oneric Ocelot.
I think that's another computer one. We have this one.
Why did you do this?
We've lost Alan.
Oh dear.
I think this one is from Kenneth Franson.
Hello, my name is Kenneth from the All in IT Radio podcast, and I pronounce Oneric Ocelot as Drömlik Ocelot, because I'm from Sweden. Yeah.
And the last one we have is from Scott Rosenquist.
Hi, I'm Scott Rosenquist, and I pronounce Ubuntu's 11.10 release Oneric Ocelot.
Cool, there we go. Wow. So, have we got a winner?
We've got a nice diverse spread there. So, if we turn to the 3D laser display screen,
the winner, put your glasses on.
The winner is displayed in 3D. Tony, would you like to announce who the winner is there?
We think the winner for this one is Kenneth Franson from Switzerland.
Should we play that winning entry one more time?
Yes.
Yeah, why not? Let's play that now.
Hello, my name is Kenneth from the All in IT Radio podcast, and I pronounce Oneric Ocelot as Drömlik Ocelot.
Drömlik Ocelot.
Because I'm from Sweden.
Because he's from Sweden.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You've listened to that way too much, haven't you?
It's great.
So, Kenneth, if you could email us in your address, and we'll be able to send the parcel to you, or Alan will make sure that's dispatched.
T-shirts and stuff. And, yeah.
And the Avenging Narwhal.
Oh, yes, you get the signed Avenging Narwhal.
Yeah, you can't keep that.
That's all right, I've got two.
Yeah. Okay, it's time to get on with the bit about Ubuntu.
And it's time for a bit about Ubuntu. Ubuntu Studio has announced that it will not be using Unity for its 11.10 release. The media focused distribution will instead use XFCE for its desktop environment for reasons including users' familiarity with the interface and long-term sustainability through possible collaboration with the Zubuntu project.
Yeah, they don't like the look of Unity because it's a bit, other than it being a bit developmental and a bit different, I couldn't really see what their objections were.
No, I can't really.
No, go on. They didn't seem to have major objections, and they didn't seem to rule it out either. Completely.
Unless they did have major objections, but they didn't articulate them publicly.
Possibly.
Hmm.
Yes. Well, if they don't put it on the internet, it was not worth reading. I'm not sure whether the extra effort of moving to a new desktop environment is all that worthwhile if they could just stay with GNOME 2 as a fallback for another release and then maybe see how Unity suits them 6 months down the line.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a bit of a strange decision, but you know, it's their derivative; they can do what they like.
This is true. It is free software, isn't it?
Isn't it just?
Isn't Ubuntu Studio mainly about the applications anyway?
Which the whole point of Unity is the user interface gets out the way, and you focus on the application. And you know, if you've ever watched Tony use Ardour or any of the other applications that come with Ubuntu Studio, he full screens them, and the rest of the Chrome around the edge is gone. So it kind of makes sense to use Unity in my mind, but what do I know?
Clearly not much.
No.
Next up.
An Ubuntu metrics team has been formed to look at measuring areas of Ubuntu that could be improved, which we currently have no data about. Examples include common causes of crashes, login speeds, and the installer's rate of success. Yeah, there's a couple of things that kind of happened at the same time. Evan Dandria posted a request to the Ubuntu Devil mailing list asking if it would be possible to have some way of tracking installer success, because at the moment we don't know whether people finish the install or not. So some way
gives them a bootable system if they do.
Yeah, or whether they just get a black screen. Yeah. You know, we've got no way of knowing. And so some way to measure that. But also at UDS, Matthew Paul Thomas gave a great talk about the unknown stuff, like, you know, we have no idea about how well users are using our system and whether it's crashing and how many times it's crashing. And that seems like good stuff to measure.
Do you think we'll be having a Microsoft-style send this bug report after a crash?
Well, we already do. It's Appled, but we turn it off.
Right.
On a release.
Not in KDE, we don't.
Well, you probably need it more than we do.
One of the things
sad but true.
One of the things that people sometimes object to with these sort of phone home things is that it's a privacy issue or what have you. I mean, having looked at Evan's proposal, it does seem fairly straightforward. It's very temporary and it just checks whether it installed and then whether it got to the first boot. Okay, but I wonder whether people will object to that on those grounds.
Yeah, the discussion's been kicked off on the Ubuntu metrics mailing list, which we'll put a link to. And, you know, lots of very intelligent Ubuntu developers have waded in, and there seems to be consensus. Yes, we need to track this stuff. It will make things better, and we should be careful in the way that we gather the information and let people know exactly what information is being gathered and give them a choice as to whether they opt in or opt out.
Fair enough. Veronix has a rundown of the key points discussed at the recent Ubuntu Developer Summit, with more detailed write-ups of each of them. One of the things that caught my eye was the possibility of Evolution being replaced with a Thunderbird.
Yeah. That was quite interesting.
As somebody who's used Thunderbird and has only very, very rarely even tried Evolution.
And has to install Thunderbird every time you install Ubuntu.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't you use, you use Roundcube for webmail.
Webmail
and Thunderbird locally. Yeah,
and then various other
IMAP clients. What do you use on KDE?
Kmail, although I've switched between Kmail and Thunderbird quite a lot, so I'd be interested to give Thunderbird another go, especially if they're going to integrate it with the notification system.
Right.
Yeah, that would be
I think that was one of the dependent things. They want it more integrated, and
the reason that I went with Kmail is because Thunderbird never really had a way of like just having it running just in the background with a little notification thing that says, ooh.
One thing that jumped out at me was the Nouveau Gallium 3D by default. So if you've got an NVIDIA card, the newish open source Nouveau driver, which has an experimental 3D support. And for some of the NATI development cycle, the binary NVIDIA driver was broken because we upgraded Xorg. So I actually started using the Nouveau driver, and it was surprisingly good. I could even play Minecraft in 3D.
Yeah, wow. I took a look on the project's website. They've got like a matrix of the different chipsets and what's supported. And compared to the last time I looked at it, they've come an awfully long way. I mean, one of the chipsets is nearly there for 3D support.
The only problem that I saw with it at the moment is they don't really take bug reports on the 3D bit.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's so experimental. Right. It's not ready yet. Yeah. So. That will change in the next 6 months.
This driver's not ready yet. It's a joke from 1996. Okay, and the next up, Mark?
Remploy, a company focused on facilitating employment opportunities for disabled people in the UK, has launched eCycle, an initiative to sell refurbished computers running Ubuntu.
Or Windows.
Or Windows.
But it's important that they sell ones with Windows.
They sell the ones with Windows if you are entitled to certain benefits.
Right.
You can't. Ooh. Not everyone can, because they're refurbished computers. They have a special refurbished license for Windows. So there's restrictions on who's actually allowed to receive those at the discounted price. Whereas because Ubuntu's free software, anyone can buy it.
And aside from the fact they run Windows, they have an option to run Ubuntu, which is good.
Exactly.
So people can like pay a very small amount of money.
Under 100 quid.
And get online with an Ubuntu-based computer.
And
I hadn't picked up on the fact that not everybody was eligible for the Windows ones, but the Windows ones are only about £3 more.
Yes.
So £95 rather than £92 compared with the Ubuntu computer.
How much is your soul worth, though, Tom?
Well, but clearly £3 for some of these people.
£3 and some benefit fraud.
Yeah. Okay. But so yes, it's nice to see people at least kind of making some efforts in that way.
And I mean, the whole the page is focused on like you can have Ubuntu and it does everything. It's not like some sort of OEMs who said, "Oh, Ubuntu is an option, but we recommend Windows."
Yeah, yeah. It's right down the bottom of the page, yeah. And nobody can see it. It's right there on the front page, yeah. Ubuntu or Windows, right next to each other, side by side.
It also seems to be a wee bit harder to buy the Windows option, because if you click Windows, you're taken to another page which gives you more information, and then you've got to say that you're on some benefits, and then every year they'll check on you. And so Ubuntu is just easier.
Yeah, we should have that with Ubuntu. We should go around checking on the income of our users. Yeah, that's a good idea.
Fair enough. And while Alan's organising that, Laura, what's in the nod about Ubuntu?
Some members of the GNOME project have suggested that GNOME 3.2 should have systemd as an external dependency, effectively making it a Linux-only project. Furthermore, John McCann of Red Hat has suggested that the project should move towards producing a full-time Linux-based OS.
Yeah, so this is going to make some BSD users and people like that quite unhappy, I should imagine. So they're trying to make GNOME depend on things, say, systemd and things which is only available on Linux, hence it would effectively become Linux only, even though in the past they've ported GTK and things, which is the graphical toolkit used behind GNOME, to Windows.
Is GNOME widely used on non-Linux operating systems?
Well, I use it. Not the whole of GNOME, but the GTK bit, because I use Tomboy on Windows and Mac.
Presumably, though, GTK would still be
ported. GTK could still be, yeah.
I guess, yeah. It's not like, yeah, okay.
And I should imagine it's more the BSD users and what have you than it would be the Windows people who are running GNOME on top of Windows. There's got to be a fairly minority market, isn't it?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
But it's, I mean, the people say, oh, it's free software, you can do what you like with it. But if GNOME reaches a point that it really is so tightly integrated with systemd that it's impractical to make it run on FreeBSD or some other platform, it's effectively kind of removing that option for them, which it's their decision, but it'll be a bit of a shame, I think, because it's a good quality desktop. And that's all in the bit about and not about Ubuntu this time.
And now it's time for your feedback.
Woo!
Acerman left us a comment on our website saying,
"There always seems to be a problem with something power-related. The Acer Aspire CPU fan kicks in for a considerable time and becomes louder, and the hard disk gets very hot. Someone at Ubuntu needs to look at this serious problem with laptops."
Aha.
Yes.
Maybe. Maybe we've tracked down the reason for the power consumption increase.
Yeah, I've got an Acer Aspire 1, an A110. 110 that I've had for a while, and there are special scripts that you have to run to get it to not whir the fan at full power all the time.
It's the same on this Mac. You have to install extra packages to do exactly the same thing.
What, even on Mac OS?
No. Ubuntu.
Oh, I see. Okay. Rich Way emailed podcast@ubuntu-uk.org to say,
"You folks seem to insinuate that the Linux Mint folks would need to choose between GNOME Shell and Unity upon GNOME 2's passing. Not true. In GNOME 3, fallback mode for platforms with Linux limited graphics capabilities is a near GNOME 2 environment, not a GNOME Shell 2D. I don't indulge much in the prediction business, but it's a pretty safe bet that Mint with a conventional desktop will be a number one download on DistroWatch fairly shortly."
Really?
Do you know what? Today, I went to DistroWatch and I looked at the stats for all the most popular. I have no credence in the DistroWatch stats whatsoever. So, for example,
mind, this is page views rather than downloads.
That's all it is. It's just page views. And this week, per day, Ubuntu got quite a lot, and so did Mint, so did Fedora. And last month, Ubuntu got quite a lot, so did Mint and Fedora. And that goes back for about 5 years. It's not changing. The only thing that's changing is distros like Mego and Magaya are more than they were, and other distros are less than they were. But I don't think it really measures what, you know, distros are really doing out there in the field.
Mm. No, that's fair enough. It's interesting that that the fallback for GNOME 3 will be effectively a kind of GNOME 2 type environment.
Yeah.
And that may be enough to keep some people happy. Maybe the Ubuntu Studio people.
And Linux Mint is insanely popular. Loads of people install it. I mean, we've had a lot of people who've said they've, for want of a better word, defected from Ubuntu over to Linux Mint, and that's fine. They're still free software users. they're still, you know, using the same set of software we are, just with a slightly different user interface.
The people's front of Linux Mint.
Absolutely. On the subject of Mint, Sorin emailed,
"As someone who moved to Linux Mint recently, I'm a bit concerned about what will happen in the next release." How interesting. "It's not yet clear which desktop environment they will choose, but I trust them to make that decision as power user friendly as possible. They're clearly not bending over backwards to accommodate new users."
I thought they were. I thought the whole thing about Mint was it's nice and friendly, and you know,
it's got Flash and it's got all this codecs
and stuff, and it's got a nice big menu that looks very familiar.
Hopefully Sorin knows what he's talking about, but I'm sure he does. He's a regular listener, a regular correspondent.
That's a good measure of someone who knows what they're talking about.
They listen to our show. None of us use Mint.
They probably know more than the people on the show do.
That's true.
Ian Barton has some suggestions for my dad in his quest to tether his Nokia phone to his Ubuntu laptop.
"You need Joku, which converts your Nokia into a wireless hotspot. There's a limited free version, however every few months they have a sale and you can buy the premium version for €5. If you have trouble setting the connection type on your laptop from ad hoc to infrastructure, or it may be the other way around." Hey, what?
Yeah.
Sorry, I read that wrong.
Doesn't matter. There's a setting you have to change it in Network Manager and it'll let you connect to the phone. I used to use this on my Nokia N82, and in fact, the internet access at the first Og camp was my N82 running Joku. That was how much internet bandwidth we had 2 years ago.
Come this year and we might have two phones next year.
John the Nice Guy Spriggs, let us know about his experiences upgrading to Natty.
"I'm happy with the release. It made a lot of sense to me from the outset, although it took a few days to get used to the sidebar, launcher, springboard, panel, whatever it's called. I find pressing and releasing the super key to get to my applications, rather than the GNOME default of Alt and F1, a bit unusual, but I'm getting there."
And Ralph Green had these thoughts.
"I've been using Unity for a couple of months now, and I wanted to give it a good fair test before I decided whether I could keep using it. I've decided it's not something I want to use. I've begun to dread using it. Ubuntu made scroll bars work less well. Someone thought it looked really cool, I bet, but it's a pain to use. In Unity, there's no way to tell two terminal windows apart when minimized. This is not making my life any easier."
That was the highlights from a very long email that Ralph wrote us.
That was, extensive and comprehensive, yes.
Yeah, it's some interesting points, you know, the idea you can't tell from the icon whether, which one of a number of instances of the same application.
Yeah, and the number of mouse clicks to get from, you know, one application to another is more under Unity under certain circumstances than it is under GNOME 2, but equally there's also Alt-Tab.
Alt-Tab I've had work well. I have had Unity crash a couple of times on me, where it just kind of throws you back to the login screen and you go, "Oh, that was quick." And the login screen loads really, really quickly. And finally, we've heard from this fella again.
"Wing Commander, Sir Arthur Curmudgeon here. It seems I'm not quite as with it as I thought. Instead of using Ubuntu, turns out I should be using Ubuntu 1104. Anyway, I heard on your last program, one chap desolately said, 'What's wrong with a small community?' Never mind, lad. It's not the size of your community that counts, it's what you do with it. I remember making a forced landing on Shetland, and the entire community turned up and floated the whole aeroplane back out to sea with me on board. But I really wanted to talk about Og Camp. Reminded me of when I was in the Scouts. Oggy, 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 and oi, oi, what was it? Oh yes, oi. Songs round the campfire, eating cold baked beans out of a tin, and making sure you securely tie the front of the tent together before the scoutmaster came round after lights out. Great days. I have a rather spacious tent you can borrow if you're going to camp outside. Actually, it's the RAF camouflage cover for a Vulcan bomber. Don't suppose they've missed it, or the aircraft. You can hide the whole team from the Ruskies, or indeed the park keeper. I don't go camping as much as I did. People would often say to me, 'Oi, mate, what are you doing in my tent?' Still, I did meet some jolly decent chaps in the police force that way. Must dash, yours, the WC."
A think he's lost it. Completely lost it.
As epic as ever.
Are you even allowed to say some of those things anymore?
Well, he clearly is, yeah. Yes. We give him the airtime.
Absolutely.
Have we considered listening to that before we put it out?
I don't know. What I listened to it. No problem there.
Good.
It's all fine. Right, and that's the end of your feedback. That's all for this episode. Thank you for listening. And once more with feeling.
That was the most deadpan. I'm itching to get out of here.
No, that was I'm trying to not laugh at the Wing Commander still.
Okay. Fair enough.
That's all for this episode. Thank you for listening.
Yay.
You can find out how to get in touch with us on our website, podcast.ubuntu-uk.org, including voicemail numbers and Twitter feeds, Facebook and IRC channels. Let us know what you think of the show, or give us your thoughts about Ubuntu and the community around it. Join us at 19:30 UTC on Tuesday the 7th of June for our next live episode.
Lovely.
Bit of a long one this evening, but a fun one, I think.
Yes.
Thank you for listening, everybody. And
cheers.
And
back to Tony's Now That's What I Call Music minus 503.
You're just jealous of my epic musical taste.
Oh, that's only for the live listeners, not for the podcast listeners.
Yeah, we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.